impression, as far as we can establish.
Maisie looked out of the window, then back at McFarlane. So Walter Meyer, is really my late husband's cousin.
And with a hefty chip on his shoulder. He was targeting you, Maisie.
He seemed a kind man, though I always thought something was a bit off. Yet you say he was focused on me?
He was here in England with a job of work to do for his country, for the Fatherland, and I'm under no illusions as to why he's given us his sob story. He's given us his poor boy background to try to soften us up before we dig deeper with the really important interrogation, and he wants to avoid the gallows. As if we hadn't had enough trouble with Nazi sympathizers in our own upper classes, and even higher than that.
McFarlane turned a page of notes.
He was targeting you as a means to gain an introduction to the Compton family, and, he hoped, to receive an invitation to the Chelstone Manor estate. I suppose he wanted to look at a life that had eluded him by a whisker of fate.
Another page turned, and then McFarlane raised his eyes from the report to look directly at Maisie.
And, needless to say, you are not to inform your father-in-law that his nephew, or the man who says he is Rupert Compton's offspring, is languishing in no less a place than the Tower of London.
Maisie nodded. Of course I won't say anything. Though Julian is very well connected, I am sure he'll know in time. He might even know already. She paused. Now, you can do something for me. I just saw two young women, both with a first aid nursing yeomanry. One of them was previously my friend Priscilla's nanny. She still has a room at their house. What's she doing here?
You know better.
I do, interrupted Maisie. But it's a fair trade of information, is it not?
At the moment, she's probably just doing clerical work.
And in the future?
McFarlane seemed to waver.
He pushed back his chair and walked across to the window, looking down at the street below, then shaking his head. He turned back to Maisie, but did not take his seat.
That's a fresh idea from our new Prime Minister, though you could say he's not that new, having just had a baptism by fire in the exalted position. The young lady to whom you refer is one of the women we've earmarked as having special skills.
He took his seat once more and turned to his notes, waiting for the penny to drop. Seeing as I doubt you're interested in her quite amazing proven ability to silence three rambunctious boys, said Maisie, then I suppose you can only be interested in her fluency in French, especially colloquial French, and her familiarity with French culture. What's going on, Robbie?
Something we were going to speak to you about in time, Maisie, this new plan from our higher-ups. Not that I hold with it completely, but I see the value in it, especially now.
My French isn't good enough for whatever you have in mind.
Of course it isn't. We had enough trouble with you in German. Languages area, not exactly your abiding strength, are they, Maisie? And you won't leave that little evacuee girl. I know that now. September, isn't it, that you've got your hearing?
He raised his eyebrows in a conspiratorial fashion.
Anyway, where was I? Yes, as I was going to say, you may not be the most fluent speaker of French, but you know character, Maisie. And for what we have in mind, someone who can judge whether a man or woman has a very long list of qualities we'll need, you're the someone we think could be very valuable in this department.
He paused.
And there is always the promise of such joyous repartee whenever you and I work together, isn't there? Anyway, all in good time, all in good time. Can't say any more now. But it might be what you're looking for in a few months, perhaps next year. A way to do your bit without your life being in danger while you're careening around in an ambulance. Yes, I know all about you and your friend, putting your best foot forward.
He gathered up the papers in front of him.
Right, that's enough of that. I've thanked you for serving your country and bringing an enemy agent to our attention. And I have given you more information than I should have about our aforesaid spy. Now, you have to get on, and we'll both forget we saw each other this afternoon.
What will happen to him, Robbie? What will happen to Walter?
Eventually, he'll be hanged. Very, very slowly.
Maisie shook her head. But... MacFarlane held up his hand to silence her.
Timothy Partridge, wounded. Gordon Sanderson, a boy of 16 doing his best for his country, dead. Francis Abel, Caldwell's former assistant, dead. And Sandy MacFarlane, 18 years of age, my nephew, dead, said MacFarlane. If you'd been caught in Munich, you would have faced a firing squad. Need we say more? I'll be in touch.
Maisie spent some 11 days at Shellstone. During that time, Priscilla and Douglas made the decision to move into a tied cottage that had become vacant on one of the manor's farms. The former tenant had died several months earlier, and the cottage had lain vacant, so Lord Julian suggested that the family could take up residence while Tim convalesced. Though until essential work had been completed on the cottage, they would be staying with Maisie. Tom had returned to Northumberland, having spent much of his compassionate leave at his brother's bedside, his uniform working a magic on the matron, who failed to reprimand him when he overstayed visiting hours. Now, on a day when the sun was shining, Maisie and Priscilla had thrown a blanket down on the Dower House lawn and were lazing in mid-afternoon warmth, only the occasional cumulus cloud passing across the blue sky cast a shadow before moving on.
"Surprisingly, I'm not at all in a hurry to return home to London full-time," said Priscilla. "Yes, there is the issue of Tarkin finishing the school year, but I have found an excellent tutor locally, a former teacher at Tunbridge School, and Tarkin's studies will be directed by him until he starts again in September, when he will most likely go to Tunbridge anyway. The man only lives in Plaxtall, so my son can rumble off to see him on that old bike he found in your shed. And if Tark doesn't like that school after he starts, then we'll find him another. My younger two have rather rebelled against the yoke of discipline."
"That's got one of you sorted out, and Douglas seems quite content working in the library, though we have to prepare for Tim coming home. Anna is very excited." Maisie looked at her watch. "She'll be back from school soon. Dad has taken out the governess cart to collect her. I'm amazed he's trained Lady to draw a carriage, and Anna thinks it's wonderful." Maisie stood up and pointed to the estate's entrance. "I can tell they're on their way because Emma is waiting by the gates at the end of the drive, and I bet the first thing Anna does is rush to the conservatory to see if Tim's home. Perhaps she'll be able to bring him out of his funk when he's here. Tom did his best for a couple of days, but I fear it's going to be terribly hard getting him to buck up." Priscilla tapped the silver cigarette resting on the arm of her wooden chair, but did not attempt to light up. "Douglas says we must let him grieve the loss, but at the same time he must be kept occupied, and then he must also rest. Your stepmother swears by the efficacy of slowly simmered bone broth, and I have lost count of the gallons we've taken into the hospital. The staff have been very good about it. Brenda will make sure Tim wants for nothing, and I think it's given her another cause," said Maisie. "Brenda likes a cause. For her, Maurice was a cause, and so was I. In fact, I believe I'm still one of her causes." Priscilla was about to comment when Anna came running into the garden, her leather satchel bouncing against her hip. She made a beeline for Maisie's open arms.
"Oh, that's a full satchel," said Maisie, as Anna slithered to the ground, giggling.
Auntie Pris, is Tim home?
I'm sorry, sweetheart, but not yet. Soon, though.
Come on. Let's all go inside, said Maisie. Auntie Brenda's made some Eccles cakes, and I think they're still warm. Tim had still not been discharged from the Royal East Sussex Hospital when Maisie caught the early train up to London on the morning of June 17th. In the meantime, life at the Dower House had become more settled, despite news of the fall of Paris on June 14th. It was time for Maisie to get back to work, and more especially to embark upon her final accounting. For work to commence on a new case, it was necessary to visit the people and places that had become significant in the course of bringing an investigation to a satisfactory close. It was a wiping of the slate, to a point, because it also encouraged greater understanding of lessons learned and errors made, so that those mistakes might not be repeated in the future. Billy was waiting for her in the office, following their extended leave.
There you are, miss. You will never, never guess what.
I'm sure I won't, said Maisie, taking off her hat and placing it on the long table in her office. The case map, outlining the Joe Coombs investigation, had been folded and filed away, consigned to the past after the contents were revealed to Inspector Caldwell. She looked from Billy to Sandra, who came into the office as Maisie was responding to Billy's greeting. "And good morning to you, Billy, Sandra. Did you both have an enjoyable holiday away from Fitzroy Square?"
"I could have done with a holiday from Lawrence's aunt," said Sandra. "She's overstayed her welcome. She is good with Martin, though, but we're relieved she's leaving at the end of the week."
"And how about your Billy?" said Maisie. Her tone was measured, knowing that Billy was bursting with news.
"I'll tell you in a minute about him, but what about Walter Miles downstairs? He's been arrested. I came in this morning and bumped into a couple of the students who live upstairs. Told me everything. The police came, all on the QT, looking around in his garden, and especially at that thing he was growing up the gutter. And the next minute, he was being carted off. Happened that day we went to Scotland Yard."
"Oh, dear," said Maisie. "I wonder what he's done." Billy looked at Maisie, his eyes meeting hers. Then he went on.
"Anyway, you asked about our Billy. He's right as rain and gone back to barracks now. He asked me if I'd seen Vivian Coombs, but I said I thought she was walking out with a fellow, and it was serious. I mean, I don't want to protect him from everything, but that Viv, well, he would need evacuating all over again if he took up with her."
Much of the work involved in the final accounting kept Maisie in London. The pub on Warren Street had been closed, with a sign informing regulars that new tenants would be taking over soon, and it would be business as usual. Mike Yates's yard was also closed, with the tall wooden gates pulled across the cobblestone courtyard where lorries had unloaded the toxic paint that had caused Joe Coombs so much suffering. Maisie visited Phil Coombs, who was living temporarily with his sister in Norwood. They talked for only a short while, as Maisie understood that Coombs might still face charges of receiving stolen goods. She wanted, however, to discuss Joe's final resting place.
"I thought about having him laid to rest with his mum, but I don't know," said Coombs. "I reckon he would like something different, and not be in a cemetery with that side of the family."
"His body has been released to you, Phil. May I make a suggestion?" Phil Coombs nodded.
"My other two only seem to care about themselves at the moment. I reckon Archie will get off light, considering what he has to say about his uncle. And he's a young man, so they'd like to see him in uniform. Enough were lost at Dunkirk, so they've got to make up numbers. But Viv, well, she violated the Official Secrets Act, and no matter how small the crime, they look upon that very seriously. She could be in Holloway for a long time, if she's lucky. At least she's not been charged with treason.
I've spoken up for her, Phil, said Maisie. I think there's a case for her to receive some leniency, though even leniency can be hard in this situation.
I know. Coombs nodded, biting his thumbnail. I know it's no good wishing it were all different, but I knew what Jimmy was like years ago, and I should have put my foot down and taken on a brewery tenancy out of London. We should have gone somewhere else, well away from him.
But Sally was his sister. She was loyal to her family, and I think Jimmy would have put upon you anywhere you ended up.
Sally should have been a bit more loyal to our family, that's what, and now I've lost her too.
Coombs seemed overcome and turned away for a moment. As he regained control of his emotions, he spoke again.
What shall I do about Joe, Miss Dobbs?
Maisie took a deep breath and exhaled. I think that when all is said and done, perhaps having Joe cremated might be the better course of action.
Then what? I don't want him sitting on my sister's mantelpiece or coming with me to prison if I'm sent down.
No, that's not what I had in mind. Phil, Joe wanted to live in the country. From the moment he went down to Hampshire, he loved it there. And he loved the land where the farmer Phineas Hutchins had offered him a job. Mr. Hutchins thought a lot of him, Phil. I can ask him if Joe's ashes could be scattered across the land. Phil Coombs nodded.
All right, yes. I reckon that's the best thing. Then I can go down there to the farm and imagine my Joe working there on the land if the old boy lets me.
Oh, I think he will. Maisie made the journey to Whitchurch by train and walked around the town, stopping on a narrow bridge to look at the old silk mill, then wandering farther afield until she was ambling alongside the River Test, following the route Joe was believed to have taken during the last moments of his life. Later she met Phineas Hutchins in the pub, and afterward he drove her back to the farm in his old van.
"He'll rest up there by that stand of trees," said Hutchins. "You can tell his father that he'll be looked after. I'll watch over him, and so will these two, and his pop when he's ready."
He pointed to the two dogs, one a seasoned sheepdog, the other a youngster ready to learn the ropes.
"They'll know it's hallowed ground. Dogs always know."
Maisie bent down to stroke the dogs, and when she came to her feet, she pressed the small silver disc engraved with the name Margny into the farmer's hand. Phineas Hutchins drove Maisie back into the town, just in time to meet Sylvia Preston for tea. The young WAAF arrived in her distinctive Air Force blue uniform, a halo of coppery brown curls bubbling from under her peaked cap.
"This is awfully good of you, Miss Dobbs. I'm starving."
Preston tucked into a scone with jam and clotted cream.
"I'm always starving. The food they give us is terrible, and what that landlady puts on the table isn't much better at all. My staple diet these days is toast."
She held up half a scone.
"And who knows how long we'll be able to get this sort of thing."
"I'm very grateful for your help, Sylvia," said Maisie. "The information you gave me was invaluable and has helped to put those responsible for Joe's death away for a long time."
"That detective from London was a bit sharp, wasn't he?"
Maisie laughed. "Detective Chief Inspector Caldwell. Consider his job, I think. It would make anyone sharp."
"Well, he didn't keep me for long, but it raised a few eyebrows at the airfield, I must say. I think it might be part of the reason why I've been promoted. Well, not exactly a promotion, but it feels like it. Not to be driving that ambulance. I'm being transferred to a new job, much better."
"Oh, that sounds exciting. Well done." Preston used her handkerchief to dab her lips and took a sip of tea. She looked around at others enjoying their afternoon tea and turned back to Maisie.
"I'm sure you don't know any German spies, so I'll tell you what it is. Sort of. She looked around again and leaned toward Maisie. They're sending me to one of the chain home stations.
Maisie moved closer to Preston.
The what?
Preston cast her glance around the tea shop again.
Chain home stations. They're stations where they have a special early warning system, and they've been set up all along the coast, so we can tell when there's an attack coming from over there. It's using radio signals, and I'll be a plotter, for what they call radio detection and ranging. We can use this system to instantly know where the enemy aircraft are located, and how many of them are coming over here, so we can get our boys up there to intercept them. We'll be able to give a decent warning if bombers are on their way.
She leaned back and began spreading clotted cream on the remainder of her scone.
That's all I'd better say. They're sending me to Ventnor on the Isle of Wight. So that's me, away from the ambulances and that terrible job. And you won't tell anyone, will you?
I wouldn't tell a soul, said Maisie. And I don't think you should tell anyone else, not even your family. I think this information is too important, Sylvia.
Maisie met Dr. Clarissa Clark at the hotel in London where she was staying while attending a series of meetings, one in connection with her findings during the post-mortem on Joe Coombs.
The interesting thing, Maisie, is that having done more research, we discovered that while the various substances used by Robertson to thin out the fire retardant and to make it go further were fairly nasty, they were not what was causing the more serious problems. The paint had been developed and then tested only to discover whether it had the required fire retardant qualities. The testing was arbitrary, a very basic affair and not conducted by scientists at the level I would like to see. They just wanted the paint on their buildings to protect them, because they were racing against time.
Will they discontinue use? Asked Maisie. I doubt it. Not the way they're constructing new airfields around the country. No, it's a time of war, so a worker who has a particularly bad reaction, someone like Joe, is only so much concomitant damage along the way.
That's terrible, said Maisie.
Clark pressed her lips together before speaking again.
It is terrible, Maisie, but so is a burning building. To die in a fire is a dreadful death. I've seen my fair share of burn victims, and I am sure I will see many, many more before this war is done.
Will there be more Joes?
I don't know. Though certainly there are going to be precautions now. I've asked for even the most simple masks to be provided to the workers, especially those apprentices who are still so young. And I have stipulated that they should wear gloves, though they tend to limit the dexterity of the working painter. And a list of guidelines I've drawn up will be issued to the companies who are currently taking over the Yates's contract. That's what my meetings here in London have been all about. She paused. The thing that worries me is not what happens to these workers now, or even in a few months, or a year. It's what happens when years have passed. This very powerful fire retardant is poison, and such contamination can remain in the body for decades, affecting every part of the human system. I am sure men will suffer in the future and never know it was all due to a job they took on when they were little more than boys.
Tim Partridge came home to Chelstone toward the end of June, to a welcome from all but his brother Tom, who was already stationed at RAF Hawking, flying Hawker Hurricane aircraft and preparing for whatever might come next in his life. Anna had taken to grabbing Tim by his right hand and insisting he accompany her to the stables to help her groom Lady. And when he objected, maintaining that a person with an arm missing could hardly groom himself, let alone a pony, she replied,
"Tim, you've got another arm, haven't you?"
And to the delight of all who observed the exchange, Tim agreed to be pulled this way and that, wherever Anna wanted his company. His recovery had begun. With her routine re-established of weekdays in town and toward the week's end the journey back to Chelstone, it was toward the end of the month when Maisie persuaded Priscilla to accompany her to Rye.
"I don't know if I can bear to go back there," said Priscilla. "Gordon's funeral was hard enough on everyone. Tim was so upset that he could not leave the hospital, but I think it was for the best."
"You should come," said Maisie. "You know what you always say about the dragon. Look it in the eye, and then keep it mollified." George checked the amount of petrol in the tank and decreed that Maisie had enough fuel in the Alvis for one more excursion. They set off mid-morning on the last Friday in June for the drive down to Rye. Parking the motor car alongside the harbour, Maisie and Priscilla walked past fishing boats, unloading their catch, and stood to remember the day Tim came home from Dunkirk.
"I still can't believe he did it, Maisie. I've been moaning for the past 3 years that Tim was the one causing me trouble, and that this sailing lark at least kept him out of the house for a while. Now he's the one who has surprised me the most, and of whom I am so proud."
"They're good young men, Priscilla," said Maisie. "Tim was incredibly brave.
I can still see him struggling to bring in the boat, and that fisherman helping him do it on his own, knowing it was only right that he be given the chance."
Priscilla wiped a tear from each eye.
"I think this war is going to make a lot of mothers proud, but for the wrong reasons. What was it Churchill said? You know, it was on the wireless. The Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. It makes my heart so heavy. Young men shouldn't have to die, and their parents shouldn't have to go through the rest of their lives making everything seem right by saying, 'At least my boy was brave,' or 'We're proud he did his bit.'"
A now familiar low rumble of aircraft engines caused Priscilla and Maisie to look up, hands shielding their eyes from the midday sun. Three hurricanes flew in formation overhead, out toward the channel. Priscilla stood on tiptoe and waved at the departing aircraft, then turned to Maisie.
"Just in case, that's my Tom up there."
Maisie waved along with her until the aircraft were out of sight. And she wondered, then, how it must feel flying across the Weald of Kent, across Sussex, over ancient woodland and patchwork fields of barley and hops down below, over farms with oast houses, their white cowls like witches' hats poking through the morning mist, and above market towns and small villages, with children looking up and waving as they passed, until they left the English coast behind. "It's time to drive back to Chelstone, Pris," said Maisie. "They'll all be wondering where we've got to."
"And Anna will be home from school by the time we get there."
Maisie linked her arm through Priscilla's and nodded. Yes, Anna would be home. This is Orla Cassidy. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of To Die But Once, a Maisie Dobbs novel, by Jacqueline Winspear. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Katie Ostroker. Text copyright 2018 by Jacqueline Winspear. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.